This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. And now you can try a bottle yourself, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And today we're going to talk about something that is very important, which is doctor-patient communication. Now, this is a subject that I've taken up in a recent book that I wrote. It's entitled How to Talk to Your Doctor About Complementary and Alternative Medicine. And it kind of explains why sometimes communication gaps exist between patients who espouse natural approaches to their health and doctors who are trained in orthodox methodology. This book is about the general problem of miscommunication between doctors and patients. It's entitled, great title, What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear. It's by Dr. Danielle Ofri. And Dr. Ofri is a physician at Bellevue Hospital. She is also someone who teaches doctors how to communicate better. She is the author of her previous book, What Doctors Feel. She's an internist. She says that the story the patient tells and the story the doctor hears are often not the same thing, and this disconnect can be hazardous to health. So without further ado, here's Dr. Ofri. It's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Okay, so what's the problem here? I mean, you say that communication is not just an extraneous perk, the doctor-patient relationship, but it's the bedrock of high-quality medical care. Why is communication problematic these days, and what should we be doing about it?
Well, it's the bedrock of medical care because the story that the patients brings to us, the doctors, that's the primary data upon which we make diagnoses, upon which we analyze problems and make treatments. And without having the patient's story as accurate as possible, we are practicing medicine with one hand tied behind our back. Because the truth is, most doctors can do medicine absent almost any technology, but not absent the patient's story. So it's not an affable bonus, just a little bedside manner, but being able to really get to the heart of what's going on with the patient. So that's the reason why it's so important. Why is it so hard today? Well, a couple of reasons. So one is we have less time with more to do. Patients tend to be sicker these days, more chronic illnesses. Visits are getting shorter and shorter. And then the electronic medical record, the EMR, now dominates the visit and kind of takes the doctor's focus away from the patient. So that degrades the communication even more.
Indeed. And so, you know, we have all this high-tech wizardry. We have all kinds of gadgets and tests and, you know, remarkable technology. But actually, the most important instrument during the exam is the doctor's mind and their ability to elicit the right kind of information from the patient. And then conversely, there are barriers on the patient's side, right? I mean, patients have some limitations too.
Well, sure. I mean, patients, first of all, patients may be not at their peak communication point. They may be stressed, anxious, worried, in pain, nauseous, vomiting. There's all kinds of reasons that make communication from the patient end less than ideal, less than it would be under normal circumstances. The patients may also have been waiting for this appointment for a month or many months and may have a list of 50 things they want to accomplish. And so there's a lot from the patient's perspective that's coming in. In addition to their medical issues, there may be language barriers, educational barriers. There could be external psychosocial issues going on, economic stresses going on that all add in challenges to communication.
So one of the big problems these days when it comes to a doctor-patient communication, and there are many barriers both on both sides. One is an increasingly prevalent problem, which is physician burnout. Tell us about burnout. You know, hey, you you trained and worked at Bellevue Hospital, as did I. So you're intimately acquainted with burnout. But how does burnout impair doctor-patient communication, ultimately endangering the patient?
Well, burnout in general, I mean, someone who's burned out, all their senses aren't working to their optimal ability. They're not listening as well. They're not formulating thoughts as well, communicating as well. So on every level, people who are burned out are not communicating well. They may be consumed with their own emotions. Their emotions may be dulled. They may be just thinking about, oh, when does the clock, you know, get to 5 p.m.? When can I get out of here? They may look at the patient as a burden. You know, this patient stands between me and getting out of here for the day.
Yeah.
And so all these things make it worse. And the person who's burned out may just feel awful. They may be depressed. They may be abusing alcohol or drugs. They may be suicidal. There are so many reasons that burnout make someone a very poor communicator.
Indeed, it results in something called depersonalization, where doctors look at patients as objects that, you know, frankly, like impediments or problems that need to be solved. And this leads to cynicism. The practice of turfing, I think, is well known to you, which is an art form. You know, doctors learn early on in their careers how to get rid of patients and lower their patient load by referring patients to other specialists and getting them off their list of patients. They also sometimes refer to patients in disparaging ways. We've heard recordings that were conducted inadvertently, sometimes during operations, that record some very disparaging things that doctors say about patients. Is this a defense mechanism that doctors undertake because they're so challenged, they're so at their wit's end?
I believe so. I mean, I'm sure there's a few bad apples of people who are just, you know, not good people. But I think the vast majority of doctors, they're in medicine for the right reasons. They came to medicine to help patients, and they really do want to do that. I think if you talk to them, absent the stress, the frustrations, they will say, this is what I want to do. Nobody wants to be dehumanizing their patients. But when people are stressed out, their resiliency goes down, their barriers to, you know, their inhibitions get relaxed, and people behave the way they wouldn't normally behave. And I think if those doctors heard themselves, they would be mortified at what they said in these moments of weakness and stress.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's a paradox here because the very self-same doctors who exhibit the most empathy, and empathy is a really important aspect of communication. We'll talk about it more in just a moment. But the most empathetic doctors, doctors who, you know, the old Bill Clinton phrase, I feel your pain. You know, these are the very doctors who are most prone to burnout, right? I mean, because they literally suffer an emotional burden sometimes from connecting deeply with patients.
Yes, it can be very hard because the more you open yourself up to feel your patient's pain, the harder it is. Today I saw a patient who might have a recurrence of cancer, and it's just the worst feeling. And it was just a terrible feeling. And for the rest of the day, it was really hard to stay focused. So when people talked about their bunions and their, the heartburn, you know, I feel empathetic, but I'm thinking about this poor patient of mine who it looks like is going to be going through that whole awful round again. It's devastating. And when you have it on a regular basis, and certainly you and I both trained, you know, in the AIDS epidemic, and those were really hard times when our patients were dying routinely and they were dying terrible, horrible deaths, and it was relentless, it can really wear you down, even if you have the best intentions.
Indeed. Well, let's talk about empathy and how can doctors cultivate empathy? I mean, to some extent, it's a natural trait. You know, people are born with maybe a little bit more of an empathy gene, but it can be cultivated as they are raised properly. But what does empathy do to elicit a better patient outcome?
Well,
by the way, in the background noise that you hear for a listening audience, that's an ambulance of some patients who are headed directly to Danielle Ofri's office at Bellevue. So, right. You know, beware. You know, you're going to get some hits this afternoon.
You know, I think that empathy, you know, one thing I noticed, people often say, oh, you know, doctors are terrible these days. But I look at the medical students coming in, and there's really hardly a bad apple. I think the students come to us with empathy, professionalism, real caring. And unfortunately, our medical training often stamps that out. And so our goal, I think, as educators, is to protect that empathy, that natural empathy, the sense of justice and fairness that I think most children have automatically. We want to preserve that and cultivate it, but protect it from being destroyed. I think if untrammeled, most medical students already come in with the right ideals. And when one is empathetic or empathic, they can really try to imagine what the patient is feeling. And moreover, they can communicate that understanding, right? It's not enough just to feel your pain, as Bill Clinton famously said. You have to be able to express that to the patient. The patient understands that you are, to the best that you can, being in your own shoes, to get a sense of where they're coming from. And I think for patients, they don't feel heard unless they get a sense that someone has either the sense of them or is making the attempt to get a sense of how they're feeling.
Yeah, one of the problems that's frequently cited as part of the doctor-patient interaction is the issue of interruption. I've read some phenomenal statistics somewhere where the patients launch into description of their problem, and it's about, on the average, about 19 seconds before the doctor interrupts.
At best.
That's part of interviewing a technique. And I think that, you know, you're probably involved in teaching medical students that listening skills are important, right? And they can be cultivated. They can be developed.
They sure can. And that interruption is, and when I talk to lay audiences about that, they're horrified when they hear that statistic. My gosh, you know, how rude those doctors are. And I try to explain that. I think we're not trying to be rude, at least most of us, but that, you know, we naturally have this detective instinct, very dogged, to get to the bottom of things. Mm-hmm. Someone says, I have this pain here. We jump right in. When did it start? When did it stop? What makes it better? What makes it worse? But if the patient had a second thing to say, like, you know, I might have had a stroke last week, we could miss that. And you can already see, you know, the seeds of misdiagnosis and medical error right there. So I try to train myself, and I talk to my students about letting the patient talk for 1 minute. Uninterrupted. You know, a minute with full frontal listening is quite a bit of time, and most patients can get out their top concerns in 1 minute. And then I'll say to the patient, you know, I don't want to miss what you're saying. Would you mind if I took notes while you speak? And I indicate the computer, and then most patients are very forgiving and understanding. Mm-hmm. So when I talk to my students and house staff about efficiency, because it's a very busy clinic at Bellevue, I talk to them about the counterintuitive strategy of letting the patient talk uninterrupted is actually a remarkably efficient technology.
It seems paradoxical, but that may enable the patient to provide you with the information you need without interrupting their flow. When we talk about communication strategies, what are you, you know, when you're involved in teaching doctors, and I know that you conduct courses not just for medical students, but for doctors who are in practice. And it's interesting that just around this time, I have the obligation, since I'm a physician in practice, of signing up for malpractice insurance from time to time. And they say, well, if you want a discount on your malpractice insurance, you should take this course. And I'm in the midst of taking a course, and here I am, 65 years of age, and I'm still being taught specifically techniques of better communication. It's interesting because these guys are out to reduce malpractice payouts. They want to see less in the way of medical liability. And yet they're teaching doctors not just, oh, you know, order a mammogram or make sure that you dot your I's and cross your T's, give an antibiotic every time you see a patient with a certain problem. They are teaching doctors how to be mindful and focused and communicate better in that precious interval where you talk to a patient.
Yeah, I agree that, and certainly with malpractice, you know, if you look at the data on malpractice suits, the vast majority of lawsuits are about communication, and only a minority are about actual negligence in the malpractice of medicine, because most patients are, I think most patients understand when a genuine error has occurred, but what they don't understand or don't can't countenance is not being able to find out what's going on. And that's really the issue. And so I think that teaching communication skills is absolutely critical for preventing or reducing malpractice.
Well, what are some of the skills that you try to inculcate in young doctors and in veteran doctors?
Well, one thing is asking the patients, you know, did I miss anything? You know, have I forgotten anything?
Yep, yep.
And that gives the patient a chance to think, oh, I forgot to add this. Oh, doc, you didn't ask me about that. Mm-hmm. That's very, you know, not only is it good for accurate information gathering, it lets the patient know that you are listening. And again, the feeling of not being listened to is often, again, the impetus for the malpractice suit. Mm-hmm. The other technique we say is summarize. Okay, let me see if I got this right. Let me see if I got this right. You told me X, Y, Z, 1, 2, 3, and then did I miss anything or did I get that right? So reviewing the information and then asking again, are there any questions that I didn't answer for you? And if you think of them later, here's how to reach me. And I find that most patients are less likely to come back with questions. If you show the doors being open to future communications, patients actually will come back with fewer questions because they can feel more relaxed. So those are a couple of very basic techniques that enable patients to feel the lines of communication are open.
One of the things that I tend to do, and I don't know whether you rate this as good or bad, is I sometimes take a pause during the conversation and I ask the patient kind of a strange question. I say, well, what is it that you think you have? You know, especially if it's some kind of enigmatic diagnosis. And it gives me two pieces of information. First of all, it might yield me insights on, you know, a potential diagnosis that's important to consider. And secondly, it tells me a lot about where that patient is coming from. And part of the doctor-patient interaction is to either confirm a patient's fears or to dispel them and provide them with information that may help to alleviate their concern about a particular problem. Is that a reasonable strategy?
Yes, and I'll often even refine that further, saying, what are you most afraid of? You'll say, I think I have, you know, this, but, you know, if you ask what you're most afraid of, out will come the, you know, brain cancer or the real extreme fears that, as you allude to, it's very important to touch upon that. You know, no, I don't think you have cancer, or, you know, there is a possibility, you know, and here's how we're going to find out. I also ask patients, you know, have you had experiences with this kind of illness before? If we come to something, you know, family members and sort of what's their view, you know, of heart disease? And they that may be, you know, a grandparent who died of cardiac arrest in front of them, or it might be someone mm-hmm. who just took a nitro occasionally, yeah. but some sense of what they think heart disease or emphysema is, so we can work from there.
Yeah, that's really important. You know, patients sometimes who come to me with headaches, I'll ask them more about, you know, what their apprehensions are. And they'll say, yeah, my Uncle Charlie, you know, we were having Thanksgiving dinner and he pitched forward into his plate of soup and he had a major stroke and he was dead. And that's that
and
kind of traumatic incident, you know, will color a person's appreciation of their symptoms and create a great deal of dread and concern when they have symptoms that might be relatively minor.
Yeah, I think it's also very important to check in the patients understand the terminology that we use. I had a patient who I discovered later was mixing up osteoporosis and osteoarthritis mm-hmm. and didn't know they were two different things. And only when this came to light, I realized that she was confused about these two illnesses. And I, you know, the two terms are popping up a lot. And I initially hadn't been aware that she wasn't clear about the difference between them. So it's very important to double check a lot of terminology that we think is obvious in MI, you know, COPD, that's not English. And most, the average person doesn't know what they are, but we sort of jot them off and the patient may be too embarrassed or shy or too, they may have missed it entirely to even know to ask what that was.
Yeah, one classic example of miscommunication was a patient who came to see a physician about what turned out to be GERD, gastroesophageal reflux. But of course, the patient was Asian, had limited language skills, and the doctor endeavored to explain to her what GERD was. And he pointed to the chest and he said, heartburn, heartburn. It's when you feel burning in your heart area. The patient came away very concerned that she had a heart problem, went and consulted a cardiologist. The cardiologist did a major workup on her and concluded she had no heart problems, and then decided to call the original physician, and the original physician admitted his error and said, maybe I shouldn't have used that terminology because it doesn't translate very well into Chinese.
Right, exactly. The terminology, I mean, heartburn sounds actually quite terrifying.
Yeah, exactly.
If you think about it.
So, yeah, I mean, so we have to watch, you know, how we communicate and recognize where the patient's coming from. All right, good. We've laid our groundwork for a discussion in part two of some better ways that doctors can communicate with patients, and importantly, how patients can facilitate communications with their doctors, because, you know, doctors, they're pressed for time. They're limited in terms of their people skills, and maybe, just maybe, there's some ways that patients can better prepare for doctor's visits and communicate their concerns. Great book, What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear. It'll help you navigate this challenging medical environment. It's by Dr. Daniel Ofri, our guest, and we'll be right back with more on the subject of communication in medicine. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.